Hi there, great to have you with us if you're watching live, and again if you're listening back on the podcast, thank you so much for listening. We're going stateside this week, and I'm really excited to chat to someone who I've met a couple of times before, but I came across years before actually meeting, which is really exciting. Doing some amazing things, not only before being in lockdown, but also during, which I think is fascinating. So I'm talking to Chad Goodman, who's a conductor and entrepreneur. Chad, it's great to have you with us, or with me even.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be on. Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. So one thing I always start with, because it's nice casual chat, is actually asking people to introduce them and what they do, because I always think it's quite interesting to find out how people define themselves in a way. So what is it that you do?
So as you mentioned, I'm an orchestral conductor. I'm currently based in Miami Beach, Florida. But arts education is also something I found very important, and we'll discuss more of that. But that's sort of a facet of the music world that I'm really exploring now during this strange lockdown that we're all experiencing.
Massive. And as you say, it's such an unusual thing, I imagine, for a conductor to be in lockdown, because you can't necessarily create the music because you're not surrounded by people in the same way. It must feel quite lonely, in effect, that you're not being surrounded by, 100 something odd musicians in New World where you're conductor in residence, or conducting fellow, sorry. Yeah. It must be very, very surreal. So I'm not sure about you, but I found this whole being in lockdown quite surreal and don't really know what day it is or if I can, have a glass of wine with breakfast or this sort of thing. How are you finding the whole situation at the moment and staying sane?
Yeah, it's very strange. It's changed. I think it's shaped how I think, how I approach creativity in a very different way. I've actually overall felt very inspired during this lockdown, but through other forms of art and through looking at music through different lenses. So I feel like I've been on a creative spurt that I'm focusing a lot on literary art and poetry. I've been doing a bit of writing and a tremendous amount of reading, more than I've done in a very long time, unless it was like reading tied to score study, whether it was a biography on Beethoven or something. It's just pure, reading a lot of fiction and looking at a lot of visual art as well. So,
oh, wonderful. And it's I think it's quite nice to have that time and almost give yourself the permission to do things differently now and actually explore things that you don't necessarily have the time to. Although I did see a very funny meme where it was saying, in the past I thought I couldn't write that play or that novel or draw art or do cooking because I was too busy. And it turns out I'm just really untalented and lazy. Which I thought which did make me laugh, which I think there's some element of truth in there. You're like, oh yeah, maybe it's the me bit and I should get started with these things rather than wait for it to have the time. But I think it's really interesting you have all these different passions and ideas and influences. So I think I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, I actually came across you before meeting you in Miami at the New World Symphony. Actually, it was a couple of years before, with an article about you in Forbes magazine about music and entrepreneurship and what you were doing. And I think there's some fascinating bits in there where you weren't just doing music, you were collaborating with people that you would never really expect. Before we get onto those projects themselves, what really drew you to entrepreneurship in classical music?
Well, my entire childhood, I grew up playing trumpet, and that was the definition of my life. By the age of 12 or 13, I was already telling people I'm going to be an orchestral trumpet player. I'm going to be principal trumpet of the New York Philharmonic. That was the dream. That's what I was going for. And I ended up doing my bachelor's at the Eastman School of Music in trumpet and moved to San Francisco, where I did a master's degree in trumpet performance. But I happened to stumble into conducting during grad school and continued on teaching trumpet, playing, freelancing with several of the orchestras around the California Bay Area. But I knew I wanted to do more conducting, but I didn't want to go back and do more degrees. I didn't want more academia. I thought, I'll use a field of dreams mentality. If I build it, they will come. I'll start my own group. I'm already freelancing as a trumpet player with all these wonderful players who, are always looking, who isn't looking for more work. And if I can provide them work that's interesting, that I can actually find a way to pay them to do, then they might start prioritizing my group, where I'm essentially just doing it to get experience conducting. They might start to prioritize that over other groups. And so I decided to form an ensemble, a flexible instrumentation group called Elevate Ensemble. And it was up to 18 players, I decided. And from the start, I knew I had to look at things from a business mindset of how am I even going to fund this? I can't fund a full symphony by myself. I have music degrees. I didn't study business. I didn't, you know, study finance. So I thought, well, let me have something that's almost like a pickup orchestra. You know, I can just move it, pocket-sized orchestra from venue to venue, and I can find a way to pay 10 to 12 people much easier than, you know, 30 to 60 players for a chamber orchestra or a small symphony orchestra.
Yeah, I think it's quite a good way of getting into it and starting quite nimbly and not having huge grand dreams of saying, I'm going to have a 120-piece orchestra. I can run that on my own. It's fine. And I always found from starting my own business that there's so many things you never even know that you have to know or expect that you have to do. And all of a sudden you're thrust into doing this. You're like, crap, what on earth do I do? What sort of challenges did you have when you were getting started? Because I think obviously overcoming challenges is something that we all have to do now.
Yeah, well, like you said, I was just having flashbacks as you were saying all the things you didn't think about. And if I had like any idea of what amount of work it would take to run an arts organization, I don't know if I would have started it. It's just I was very naive, so I just came into it so doe-eyed and, you know, just pure-hearted of like, this is what I want to do musically, this is what I believe in, and I want to share with the Bay Area community. I'll figure it out. But I mean, my very first show, I needed a venue, and a friend recommended a yoga studio that his girlfriend was working at and said it's a beautiful space. It was an old Freemasons building that was converted into a yoga studio. It was 20-foot ceilings, you know, beautiful hardwood floors, but they've never done anything besides yoga, you know, workshops or things. They've never rented to a musician. So I used a yoga studio, and I showed up for the first rehearsal the week of the performance. I had three rehearsals and a show. The very first rehearsal was maybe 8 p.m. and showed up with 18 musicians. All of us brought our music stands and our, you know, sheet music, and we show up, and first of all, apparently the class that had just gotten out was hot yoga, so the room was disgusting. It was, yeah, and talk about, you know, all my woodwind and string playing, you know, friends who were in the group just being able to, what is intonation when the room is still steaming? So that was the first thing that happened that I didn't think about. And then we set everything up, and I say to the owner of the studio, we're all here, we got everything set up, thank you so much, just tell me where the lights are, and we're good to go. And she looked at me and said, oh, in our yoga studio, we only believe in natural light. And I said, this is the evening, the sun's already set. I have 18 musicians here with stands and music. I didn't think to ask about electricity, I suppose. So that was where I started.
Yeah, like having lights is something you just normally assume is a thing. Like, I think that's a fair assumption. But
yeah, so I feel like I started at rock bottom in that sense that I didn't even have light. My first rehearsal, I was like, okay, guys, let's get your instruments out. I had stand lights for a piece I was doing with video projection, but not enough for the largest piece on the program. So I was like, get out your phones, use your flashlights, I'm sorry. So that was day one of my adventures in running my own ensemble.
That is unbelievable. And it's, yeah, the things you'd never expect. And you sort of look back and you can laugh, but at the time, I imagine, sort of like heart pounding, just like, crap, what happens? Will these people come back if like they're put off by the experience as my musicians?
Oh. Yes.
Well, at least I guess the humidity is a good like preparation for being in Miami and getting into this whole like temperament there. I could not cope. So I spent sort of 3 to 4 weeks over the period of 2 months there in September and October and just melting whenever I went outside, which is... We were talking a little bit before the podcast started, and you've actually gone back to leave Miami at the moment. So you're now in Maryland, which I guess is a lot nicer temperature-wise. So when you were doing all your collaborating with the ensemble, you did it with some, I'd say, some slightly unusual people or unusual vocations, etc. What sort of people did you collaborate with? Because there's one that I'm fascinated by.
Yeah, so I wanted to make sure that as I developed my audience, that I was always generating new audiences that weren't even necessarily classical music or contemporary music fans. So I always tried to incorporate every season, at least into one or two shows, other artists from other forms. So I worked with photographers, videographers. I did a house concert of three sets of chamber music split up with poetry readings by a local poet, and then I commissioned a composer to write a musical interpretation of the final poem that was read during the reading, which he wrote for a string quartet and alto flute. And chefs. I had a wonderful series of collaborations with an incredible chef in San Francisco.
Chefs was the one that I was wanting to ask you about, because it seems such an unusual thing, and also where do you even begin to understand how that works? So what did that actually look like in reality for collaborating with a classical music ensemble and a chef?
Yeah, so I worked with this incredible chef named Eric Chow, and he was brought into the folds, particularly for our house concert series. We did many shows just rotating through beautiful Victorian homes throughout San Francisco, and we decided we wanted tapas-style menus for each of them. That would sort of, not necessarily, I know a lot of small groups do these pairings, Beethoven and, this food or this wine, and it wasn't necessarily that the food absolutely resonated with the piece, but that there was a flow throughout the night of food and music woven together in a really seamless fashion. And so it was, we would send him all of the music ahead of time as well, and he would create, it wasn't necessarily, like I said, tailored, bespoke to a, oh, this is Prokofiev, this dish was inspired, but he had on that music while he was sort of brainstorming and dreaming up all of this amazing food. So it was just, we had people who showed up because they knew our chef. And that was what was exciting about these collaborations, is I had people who had no idea who the hell I was, who Elevate Ensemble was, what classical music was. And my core audience I ended up developing with Elevate from the very start. The majority of my audience were millennials from the tech and finance sectors who had never been exposed to classical music.
So, amazing. And what sort of response did you get to these people who'd never been exposed? Was it sort of confusion, joy? How did they engage and react to it?
Oh, I'm absolutely enamored by it. And it's funny, as conductors, for us, whenever we apply for a conducting job or a fellowship, we of course have to submit video footage of ourselves conducting. So we're always setting up a camera behind the orchestra facing the podium so that people can see what we're doing. But when you do this for a show, you also get to see what the front row looks like. What do people look like when they are listening, or maybe they're not listening? And the thing I kept finding when I'd be watching my conducting footage was that the people behind me, and all these are very young people, and like I said, the majority were not really exposed to the classical music world, would be like sitting, leaning forward, and really, really engaged. And when we talk about the fact that people now more so than ever have shorter and shorter attention spans, and there's so many ways to get distracted, and there's so many options for everything, what we do with any given free, bit of time, it was just really exciting to see that they were really engaged with the music. And I did a tremendous amount of work with living composers, and we had a composer in residence program. And the thing I found appealed most to this audience were the commissions, were our world premieres, which I think in classical music we often associate with, serialist music, very hyper-academic music of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. So people get really uptight. They won't even go see a show, a performance, if they hear there's a world premiere, or they'll skip the first half. But for this audience, everything was new to them. A Beethoven trio was new to them. Stravinsky Octet was new to them. And the commission was. And what I found was they loved that they were there to be a part of this premiere. And I think we take it for granted that a world premiere, that's not something that's common in most people's daily lives. Most people don't get to be part of something that's never happened. That doesn't happen when you go to your 9-to-5 job, in an office building necessarily. And so they loved that, and they loved learning about it. And they just were very hungry for information, and that they wanted it to be delivered in a way that, they were not being talked down to, nor were they being talked, was it going over their heads. So I always was striving to connect in a way that felt approachable for those who don't know what's going on, and also in a way that didn't feel like, for the hardcore enthusiasts, that I was, boring them.
Totally. And I think we're almost a bit dismissive of new audiences and what they're going to actually engage with, and we always think that we need to, in the UK there's a phrase, bums on seats repertoire, for sort of like the music that, like, we'll put on Beethoven 5 and, like, we'll get audiences to come because the sort of general person on the street will know it. But as you say, I think we have this whole audience of experience seekers who want to go to new things and try and experiment, and all that everything's new and it doesn't really matter. So I think it's great that you're pushing forward with new music and commissioning with that. Obviously, we're going through a bit of an unusual period now, and normally you would be mid-season with the New World Symphony.
Yeah.
What do you think, it's a big question, what do you think is going on with the classical music at the moment, and how is it affecting orchestras in the States? Which I imagine could be a good, like, two-hour, answer to that one.
And God knows we've all had enough time to really think about this in the last... I think, obviously, it's caught everyone off guard. It's such an unusual time. I think all of the organizations that have been proactive over the years in incorporating digital and filming it, whether or not it was just being filmed for archival purposes, that they now, those of them who just sort of did that, New World films so many, you know, or all of their performances, they don't necessarily share all of them, but now they've just started this beautiful archive series where they'll do a 15-minute chat with MTT and a few of the musicians and coaches about a piece, and then they just play the piece from the archives, the video. And so those organizations that have that are going to absolutely thrive, and those who have it at the highest possible level, you know, shot in HD and all that. But until then, my take is that we need to be focusing on educating audiences. Everyone's home. Everyone has time. We're an industry that is always having to stand up for ourselves to say, oh, we're not dying, we're thriving, we're growing. Well, now's the time that we can connect with all of the audiences that don't come to our concerts, because they are all on their phones, they're all on their computers. We have such a saturated social media world right now with everyone performing, which I love. I love seeing everyone performing. And but I'm focusing, obviously, like you said, as a conductor, I can't participate in that necessarily. As you know, I can't just have the solo pieces that I can do, you know. So I'm focusing on the educational aspect. So I started a YouTube channel to talk about, what does a conductor do? What's going through my brain? How do I prepare? And then, you know, I'll take a look and break down some of my favorite pieces, you know, and go over things. But that is where I think we need to be focusing right now, using this time to present music as we're doing, present chamber music, all these beautiful solo, you know, series from musicians' living rooms. Let audiences get to know the names and faces of the players, because honestly, unless you're the conductor or the soloist in an orchestra, you don't really, people don't, might not know who you are, and that's a shame. And this, I think, is a real opportunity for people to go, oh, I know by name six people in the second violin section of my town's orchestra. And I think that's really special. And could lead to a lot more investment in our field. So
massively. I think you really hit the nail on the head there. And one thing I always like to say is that social media is in essence social. And I think in classical music, on social media, in the past, we've been quite guilty of just projecting or broadcasting, and rather than focusing on this personal side that we should really do. And I think it's amazing when you look at the sports world and the fans that sports teams have. And they will not only know every single player in the starting lineup, they'll know the reserves, the substitutes, the junior team, all this sort of stuff. And then all those players will have their own profiles, whether it's, say, the New York Jets or Manchester United and things. Like, people will know all the personalities. And in reality, I don't think I know in orchestras who all the different personalities and things are. And as you say, this could be a great opportunity to explore those. So as you just mentioned, you've started a YouTube series, which I genuinely have been really, really enjoying. And it's quite nice to actually say there's content I like in classical music. And as you mentioned, you're answering big questions about what conducting is. So what are some of the sort of the topics that you've covered, and what response or engagement have you had with people as a result of it?
Yeah, so I mean, conducting has always been this mysterious kind of occupation, you know. It's something that people have always had a lot of questions about, and I think there are so many roles and responsibilities of a conductor. It's very difficult to just say in one concise sentence what a conductor does. So what I've decided is I've unrolled this series where I take a look at one facet or one aspect. So I had a video that was focused only on cueing. how do conductors cue? What's the importance of it? Why is that even necessary, you know, when you have all these great musicians around you? Then I did a video where I discussed how I think a conductor is very similar to a sound engineer sitting at a mixing board. And the idea is you're also maintaining and adjusting all the balances in the moment so that the audience is getting the best collective sound. And then, you know, I sort of explain that it really is an anticipatory job. So you're always ahead of, you know, of the ensemble by a split second. Then you're doing all these adjustments in the moment, in present time. And then you're also thinking further into future time about how the piece is going to unfold. And so I think just sort of shedding some light into these complexities that look very simple. The job of a conductor looks very simple, but there's a tremendous amount of thought and multitasking that's happening at any given moment, let alone the rehearsals, which are the most important and challenging aspect of conducting. The performance, when people ask if I get very nervous about performances, I don't feel that as much. Of course I do. We all get anxiety and a little bit, you know, butterflies in the stomach. But the performance is the easy part in many ways, because it's how do you stand in front of a group of professionals who have all been playing for years. And often as a young conductor, they've been playing this music since before I was born. How do I get in front of them for 3 to 5 rehearsals and really, you know, bring things to another level? So this whole series is just sort of breaking that down and humanizing all of the strangeness that is what I do on a daily basis.
Definitely. And I think just from you mentioning a few things there, even musicians don't necessarily know. And as you mentioned about what is cueing a musician and how do you cue them, I've been sat on front desk of cello sections a couple of times and someone will mention a cue and you see the conductor sort of write frantically or something in their parts. And I've never actually sort of decided or thought what on earth are they doing or what is their thought process or procedure for doing that. And it's also, I think, for people on the outside, a position that has a bit of mystique around and that people don't necessarily know what people do, but it's a term I don't like, but sort of the art of the maestro type thing. And there's a lot of curiosity from the general public as to what conductors are. So I think it's great that you're shining a light onto what it is. And I guess your background as an entrepreneur is quite useful now because you're obviously having to re-engage with your thought process and skills of how can I analyze what an audience is, how can I connect them, what happens if there's no light in this yoga studio where I'm filming a video. Have you found it quite sort of thrilling and engaging to sort of now have to tackle something new in a problem-solving entrepreneurial way?
Yeah, I feel very positive about it right now. I mean, the reality is that, of course, I don't know the next time I get to do what I do as a conductor, which is very sad. It's a sad place to be mentally, where I don't know the next time, because my job has to be, like you say, with dozens to hundreds of people. But focusing, I'm really putting all of my efforts into this educational side and just trying to get people really excited about it so that when we do have that return, however that may look, whether it's, you know, reduced audiences at first or majority of people tuning in online, whatever it may be, that they are just so excited and revved up about it, you know, that they're going to be even more grateful to be sharing that experience. So I've been really positive about this at the moment. And it's giving everyone a break. Like you said, it's important for us to take breaks. I'm a very type A person. Go figure, most conductors are. But I love working. I love being busy. I'm always, if I'm working on, you know, studying something for next month, next week, next month, next year, it's just there's always things I can be doing. And for all of us to collectively be able to just breathe a little bit, sit at home, maybe go for that walk through the park, you know, I think that's really healthy for all of us too at the moment to have this break. It's the worst reason to have a break, but I think there's a lot of health benefits to it right now as well.
Totally. I think I'm quite similar with the type A thing and sort of always wanting to work. And when in the UK this kicked off, it was sort of a week of cancellations before lockdown was announced. So we sort of preempted it actually happening. And obviously the whole music industry was very confused, I think, for want of a better word, as to what was going on. So yeah. I decided to start sharing some of my experiences and thoughts and processes, and did a blog series of how to be a musician online, and got completely carried away with trying to help people, and did something like, I think it was 12 or 13 blogs in the first 6 days. I think it was 15,000 words, more than I wrote in my entire time at university, because I was a cellist and therefore was lazy and didn't really do essays. And yeah, I got to like the next week and I was just absolutely drained and had to completely take foot off the pedal and like take stock, mm-hmm. one of just that I can't work constantly, and also that at the moment we should probably be a bit more aware of looking after ourselves. And yeah, week three felt a lot better after having a week of just taking it off a little bit. Yeah, it wasn't the best laid plans at the beginning. It was very reactionary, which is great, but slightly chaotic. So one thing I've been really interested about, partly as from doing the blog, is seeing how musicians are reacting. And lots of questions are being asked as to how they can do things, whether it's very practical or more theoretical. For people who are starting their own projects, particularly with being online, what sort of advice do you have for musicians and their creative ways of thinking?
I think the most important thing with creating anything is to just start it as a type A person. And with me starting this YouTube channel, which was something I hadn't really even thought of until the first week of this lockdown, I always want everything to be right from the start. And I think there are a lot of people that can relate to that. And a lot of musicians are creatives who feel that way too. And so for me, I think the best piece of advice is just start. If you don't have the greatest professional level, microphone, who cares? If your video quality is not great, who cares? If you have 5 followers, let's say you just got on Instagram or you've just started a YouTube channel and you have no, just start doing it. And like you're saying, just get in the habit of creating and doing it as consistently as you can. And like you with the YouTube channel, I think I filmed 12 videos in 7 days or something. So I've set up, I still haven't released everything yet. But then I did that, and then I needed the break, and I thought, what can I do consistently? It would be impossible to keep up that level. So I went, I'll release 1 video a week. That's feasible. And then you get in the habit of that. And okay, so make it bite-sized in what you're doing as well, something that is attainable. Having super lofty goals is great, but make sure that it's broken up into things you can check off a checklist. And speaking of that, I was talking with someone again, another music educator the other day. I love checklists, like post-it notes, sticky notes. I have always right next, like basically in every room of my place. And I like to make them for every day and just have things I can do. Because it's very hard to, it's easy to feel like you don't accomplish everything you want to do every day. But if you can make a checklist, the first thing on my checklist is write a checklist. And then I cross it off immediately. That's literally written at the top. Because we need that serotonin boost or this dopamine boost of like we've done something and that's okay, and so compartmentalize it into bite-sized pieces, whatever your big goals are, but just start doing it and just get in the habit of continuing to do it, because it's so easy to give up, and you just need to make it so that you feel that reward of, oh, I accomplished this today. Little victories. It's hard as an adult, but we need to appreciate them like little kids do.
Oh, definitely. And I'm 100% the same. And one quote when I was starting my business, that I was very much perfectionist and wouldn't do something until it was 100% perfect, and therefore it delayed me actually doing things. And came across the quote, perfect is the enemy of good. And it's one of the things that you're not going to start doing good things if you're constantly aspiring for this perfect thing that's never going to be attainable. And I think we're musicians, we're slightly susceptible to that in our non-musical life because we're so used to only going on stage when it is perfect in inverted commas, or you're ready to do something at the highest level. So I think, as you say, like, just go for it and experiment. And I think at the moment there's never going to be a more sympathetic and enthusiastic and appreciative and grateful audience. This is where people will 100% cut you slack that you're not filming on an amazing camera or you're stuttering online or whatever it is. I think people are really going to be wanting you to do well, and there's that level of goodwill.
That is so true. I think people are just so hungry for connection right now. That's, I think, the big takeaway from this whole pandemic and lockdown has just been we take for granted the simple things of just being able to communicate and feel connected, symbiosis with other human beings. And so, audiences, it's the least judgmental audience I've ever come across. I'm getting more support for, my YouTube channel and other things I'm trying, and than I've ever experienced. So you're dead on with that, spot on.
Massively. Well, I think a really interesting thing you just mentioned is that we're all looking for connections at the moment. And New World Symphony is quite a unique orchestra, not just because it's a training academy, but because I think all of the orchestra all live in the same apartment complex, or there are a couple of people who are elsewhere potentially. But it's a very sociable orchestra with everyone living around each other and being with each other 24/7 almost in working lives. How are you staying connected on a sociable level as an orchestra? Which I imagine must be quite a surreal thing now you're taken out of it.
Yeah, I mean, New World's. It really is unlike any other institution I've come across. Everything they do is the highest possible level. They're so adventurous. They experiment. It's a music institution that embraces trying and failing. They literally have, I believe last year or maybe 2 years ago, donors, philanthropists started an entire fund that's literally the experimental fund. It's literally just for like, you have that crazy idea. Try it. If it crashes and burns, whatever. And so to have an arts organization that is so on the edge like that is wonderful. And so they've done a great job with keeping us all connected. We have happy hour Zooms with, a whole orchestra chiming in. They continually reach out, and they have in their newsletters, and they post online, sort of all of us are sharing. They really just keep asking us all to share. How are we, dealing with this lockdown? What are we doing? Where are you? And so they're sharing that within the orchestra, within the rest of the administrative staff, and with our audiences, our patrons, and just musicians around the world. They have this new archived video series that they're just releasing, I think, almost on a weekly basis, maybe every 2 weeks, of just great, beautiful footage from past performances. So they're really being proactive about keeping everyone involved, checking in. It feels like a family, which is wonderful. I mean, that's what we all want, I think. And it's not easy to attain all the time, and particularly now, but they're really being proactive. So I'm just so proud to be a part of their institution right now.
Massively. I think it is something that's really unique. I was completely taken back as to just how sociable and welcoming everyone and almost communal the whole orchestra is. On my so when I was there, I was staying in the apartment complex for New World Symphony, and on the last day, I was about to leave, and someone mentioned, "Oh, you should come downstairs and sort of come and join the orchestra." There's Oktoberfest and a Hogwash downstairs, and it's in Miami. And if I hadn't been known, I would have just wandered out and seen lots of people in lederhosen and a hog roast and beer kellers, and I've been so confused with like palm trees at the same time. Yeah, but once the initial surprise of like, yeah, sure, why not? It makes sense. Yeah, it was so much fun, and it was such a great welcome. And I think in the music world, we're quite good at welcoming people because we're always on tour, and it's a sort of a transferable family, but especially there, it was something that was very unique. So before we let you go to creating more videos or post-it notes, what have you seen over the last few weeks that's really made you smile in terms of classical music? What projects or videos, or even if it's just ways of people interacting that you've really enjoyed?
Yeah, I mean, there's like we were saying, there's been so much. It's even hard to kind of narrow it down. But well, I just reposted this video I saw yesterday that someone did. Someone just did this ridiculous, just added in these little animations to a video of Dudamel conducting, and it's just like when his hands like this, it's like. A dumbbell enters in there, and then he's like holding up a giant painting, and it's just like animating the ridiculousnesses that is what we do as conductors. And I was just dying, so I absolutely loved that. I thought that was a very funny approach. I'm loving all of these videos. There have been a lot of sort of crossover collaborations that I've really enjoyed. Chris Thiele, I know, just recently posted himself playing some Bach on mandolin, and then was asking people to fill in the other parts, and so. Seeing those types of videos where one person posts, something and says, "Hey, just do your best, add to this, mix this in, and send it back." It's just been really cool because you can see how different musicians take the same material, well, the exact same material, the same, core recording of one person playing it. It's never going to change. It's that tempo. It's that, but hearing how different it can be when you include other voices. has been really great. I've also loved, outside of classical music, the visual art world. All of the museums, I don't know if you've seen, have all these arts challenges where people are recreating, you know, all of the famous paintings or sculptures in their apartments, and they're just ridiculous. So I've been loving that and trying to figure out what I can do. You know, is there a Picasso that I can sort of, you know, morph into? I don't know. But
I saw one of my friends the other day who's quite a big gym going guy, and he did one in drag. I think it's the girl with the waxen hair, and he had spaghetti. He's nice. Completely shaved head, but he had spaghetti his hair coming off. And it's just, people are going nuts for it. It's great to see them just like fully engaging and doing things that are different, which is amazing. Well, thank you so much for being here. Obviously, you're doing so much online at the moment in general. So where can people find you on the world of the internet?
Yeah, my website's Chad Goodman Music, as well as my YouTube channel is Chad Goodman Music. And on I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, you know, the usual
smattering. MySpace, you're in there, getting retro.
Yes, MySpace, look me up on your Palm Pilots and Blackberries, I'll be there.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much. It's 100% recommend checking out the YouTube channel, especially. It's one of the best things I've seen during this time. It's really made me smile as well, so that's probably one of my takeaways. But you get to laugh now, because I know that you're quite slick at media, and so far I haven't quite worked out how to end the podcast. So usually it just kind of like peters out a little bit, and it's just general ramble into the distance.
Right. Well, you know what? I'm going to just slowly and calmly sip my tea until it ends.
So. Perfect.
An awkward lingering silence, maybe.
It's basically what happens. Well, if you've watched live, that's absolutely amazing. Thank you for watching. And again, if you've been listening back in the podcast, it's great. We're staying stateside this week. So on Friday, and I can't remember the time because I'm being very professional, I'm speaking to Anne Majette, who is an amazing music critic and journalist, who has been very instrumental in the Me Too movement in classical music in the States, who is genuinely really fascinating. So I'm looking forward to hearing her thoughts on this current crisis. So yeah, check in on Friday. Probably look on social media because I can't remember the time. So thank you much, and I'll see you all soon.